Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Aval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today from London is Dr. Mark Galeotti, a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and an honorary professor at University College London. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you.
Good to be here.
So we're going to be talking primarily about the recent truce in Nagorno-Karabakh this morning, and all the analysts right now are scrambling to determine who was the ultimate winner, really, of the struggle, whether it was Turkey or Russia. And Turkey was not a signatory on the truce between President Aliyev from Azerbaijan, Prime Minister Pashinyan of Armenia, and of course, President Putin. And what I want to ask you is, in your opinion or your view on this, who do you think ultimately came out more on top from this whole episode over the summer, well, from September on?
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting one. As you say, everyone's been scrambling for the hottest of hot takes about who was the victor. And in many ways, to be honest, the answer is really says more about the particular analysts' prejudices and assumptions about Russia's trajectory as anything else. I personally feel that this actually is something of a partial defeat for Russia, in the sense that Russia was generally regarded as being the regional hegemon in the South Caucasus. And therefore, in some ways, okay, so it's now managed to broker a ceasefire that at least has avoided the risk of Nagorno-Karabakh being totally overrun, avoided the risk of some kind of ethnic cleansing, humanitarian catastrophe. But nonetheless, the fact that it actually has had to do so by essentially largely abandoning the interests of its ally Armenia and has had to accept a Turkish role. Because it's interesting, although there are no Turkish peacekeepers, Moscow and Ankara have now agreed that there will be Turks involved in the monitoring center. So, even on a small scale, it means that the Turks have their foothold there. The Turks clearly are the backers behind Azerbaijan. And frankly, Azeri President Aliyev pretty much admits that. It was quite striking his language in his first speech when he was announcing what he described as his great victory.
That no
He
one in the world.
thanked, well, he thanked the Russian President Vladimir Putin and my dear friend, the Turkish president. I mean, there's a very definite sense of gradation there. And, Russia now has peacekeepers that some people are saying, aha, this is a further sort of Russian extension of its control in the region. Well, yes, it gives it some degree of traction, just under 2,000 peacekeepers and an undisclosed number of border guards who are also going to be deployed there. But first of all, these are expensive. I mean, they're sending their 15th Peacekeeping Brigade, that is their specialist peacekeeping unit. Keeping it in field actually costs it money, costs it sort of capacity. And it's having to, in some ways, use force, use the presence of force, to assert a degree of control that was understood up to this point. So for me, this is about managing decline. Russia is by no means out of the region. Russia still has massive political, economic, diplomatic, as well as military capabilities in the region. But it's having to, shall we say, struggle more to retain that control. And it has had to allow Turkey a foothold in what hitherto had been more like, shall we say, a Russian monopoly.
I listened to you to your podcast the other day when you commented on everything going on in Nagorno-Karabakh, and you did mention how at points Russia did sound like the as you termed it, the peaceniks in Europe at the beginning of this conflict, just sort of asking for a ceasefire and just its words falling essentially on deaf ears. And essentially the West, primarily whether it's the European Union and the United States, they did ultimately seem pretty helpless in terms of having any capacity to solve this round of fighting. And of course, in the beginning, Russia seemed very unsure on how exactly to intervene, since it has good relationships with all of the parties involved. And you wrote in the Moscow Times earlier this week that even though Russia is recognizing that Azerbaijan essentially triumphed, that it was able to solidify its military gains, but this was delivered ultimately by Turkey. So what I want to ask you is, has this kind of like support to the hilt that Turkey's given to Azerbaijan really affected Russia's standing there? Or, you know, of course, now with Armenia, now that they're protesting over this truce agreement?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. If we cast back, I remember being in Baku some years back, and it was this sense of, it was actually quite interesting, almost kind of Casablanca type sense of everyone having their own agendas. And the fascinating thing was that you would encounter Russian and American, but also Turkish and Iranian and Israeli and all kinds of other military advisors, security advisors, representatives, and so forth. There was that very clear sense that there was a struggle going on to have some kind of foothold in Baku. And what's clear is that it is the Turks who, in that respect, have succeeded because they're willing to offer more. I mean, if one looks at what the Turkish kind of contribution was, people obviously focus on the Turkish drones, but I mean, Azerbaijan bought those drones. It's not actually as if it was simply a gift. Actually, the real Turkish role was precisely in being a kind of big brother, being visible there, you know, sending some F-16 planes to sit on Azeri airfields to discourage and deter any long-range Armenian attacks, for example. It's still fairly murky how far there was this presence of Syrian mercenaries recruited and paid by the Turks, but it quite likely was there. But more to the point, Turkey was obviously providing a degree of political top cover. And I think this was also, after all, difficult for Russia. There is no question at all that Russia could have delivered a convincing military counterstrike, or just simply a sort of have a deterrent impact if they've been willing to do it. I mean, it's interesting that very shortly before this, we'd had the Kavkaz 2020 military exercises, in which actually one of the capabilities that was actually explicitly war game was precisely deploying paratrooper forces, whether by parachute or just by plane and helicopter, quickly into a contested zone and doing so successfully. In this particular context, Russia felt it couldn't do that. It didn't want to align itself. It didn't want to totally burn its bridges with Azerbaijan, which, up to this point, has done all the right things in the sense of it has formally and overtly genuflected to Moscow. It hasn't tried to challenge it. It retains, an authoritarian regime. It certainly hasn't had any truck with these sort of color revolutions that Russia so fears. There was an element in which they really didn't want to create some kind of a showdown in which Baku would be forced to make a choice. And that's probably because they didn't know quite what Baku would choose, or that they feared that it would choose Ankara over Moscow. So again, I think in this case, Turkey's role was crucial, not on the battlefield, but in the political battlefield, shall we say. And it absolutely played to Moscow that, for all its bombast, does have considerable insecurities about its status in its near abroad. Ukraine is essentially lost. Belarus is in crisis. Central Asia, well, even there, we've recently had risings in Kyrgyzstan, which the Russians really didn't know what to do about. Plus, also, there's the growing Chinese role there. And in the South Caucasus, again, Georgia is still in some ways contested at a kind of elite level, but ordinary Georgians frankly regard Russia as their oppressor and the threat. Armenians now, again, it's interesting to see how it plays out. In the Russian press, you see coverage of protesters saying, "Russia is still our friend." In a lot of other more independent media, you're getting a lot more, and rightly so, Armenian dissatisfaction with what their ally Moscow did. So, generally speaking, I think this is it. Turkey has, by its presence in the region, in some ways called Moscow's political bluff.
You mentioned it already earlier in the context of the truce that there is no active Turkish role in the peacekeeping mission. There's no Turkish troops going to be patrolling alongside these 2,000 Russian soldiers that are going to be arriving to the Lachin corridor. It's not going to look anything like, say, what we're seeing in Idlib, where they got the joint patrols. And, you know, this is something that Azerbaijan had mentioned at a few points during the course of this conflict, that they wanted to see Turkey get a seat at the negotiating table towards any final resolution to what happens in Nagorno-Karabakh. And at the Valdai Forum, Putin kind of hinted that he would be fine with possibly looking at small changes to the current OSCE format, where, you know, right now it's Russia co-chairing with France and the US as the main mediators in the conflict. But we didn't really see anything follow that. Do you think there's any chance that this format could actually change if Russia wanted it to? Or do you think that Russia is still reluctant to accept more of a larger Turkish role in the South Caucasus?
I suspect that this is in some ways the price Ankara gets for victory. It is to be denied the outward appearance of victory. I mean, I think obviously, yes, from Turkey's point of view, ideally it would be more involved. I mean, it may or may not actually want to have joint peacekeeping patrols. I mean, that they are logistically complex, politically vulnerable things. In many ways, it's fine. Let the Russians spend the money and do all the hard work. There are going to be some Turks in the coordination center. So there is going to be a Turkish presence there, even if it's a very small-scale one. But, you know, a small-scale one is politically still significant. But the point is, you know, everyone knows that Turkey played a crucial role in this. It's really a question of allowing the Russians in some ways to save some degree of face. It's always a useful way if you want to make a deal, rather than pushing them into a position where they felt absolutely backed into a corner and they had no choice but to act in a much more muscular way. So, I mean, I think this actually counts as a political victory. Now, in the future, let's be blunt. If Moscow wants to involve Turkey, it's going to be very hard to keep Turkey out. Because when it comes down to it, I mean, we've seen this, for example, at the moment with French President Macron, you know, claiming to want to play some more significant role. But in some ways, almost having to petition to be allowed to do so. It says actually the extent to which Moscow is able to be the gatekeeper in this respect. So if it wants Turkey in, it will. However, that will be even more embarrassing, I would suggest, for Moscow. The only reason they would do that is either because there's some kind of dramatically worsening situation on the ground where they absolutely feel they need to let Turkey in, or if it's part of some wider bargaining process. Russia and Turkey, after all, have a very, very complex relationship. It's a strange frenemy-esque one. In some ways, they actually have very congruent interests. And elsewhere, if you look at Syria and Libya in particular, well, their proxy forces are fighting against each other. So we can't exclude the notion that there'll be some kind of deal elsewhere, which may well manifest itself in a greater Turkish role over the Nagorno-Karabakh issue. But as I said, I think that's something separate that will be a result of very kind of hard-nosed, pragmatic geopolitical negotiation.
You know, it makes me think about one of the provisions in the truce agreement, and that was that it was given a timeline of 5 years with an automatic renewal, provided nobody was to walk away from that agreement unilaterally. Do you think that, say with that kind of language and the kind of detente we have going between Russia and Turkey in this area, do you think it's accurate to say that essentially this truce just refroze the conflict and they're just trying to buy time, similar to 30 years ago when this all first began?
It could well be. It's hard because we have to realize that however much sort of outside hegemonic powers like Russia and Turkey sort of have a considerable influence on what happens, you know, we can't exclude the passions and the interests of the people on the ground. I can't see either Moscow or Ankara looking to kind of reopen this. I think this current frozen conflict in some ways suits both of them quite well. It gives Moscow continued traction in the region. it gives the Turks a continued reason why, frankly, the Azeris need them. On the other hand, the passions in both Azerbaijan and Armenia are still very, very raw, you know, both because of recent and historical events. And although the semi-autonomous Nagorno-Karabakh leadership at the moment have signed on to this ceasefire deal, well, let's be honest, they had no real choice because the Azeris forces' next stop would have been Stepanakert, their capital. But nonetheless, in the past, they have often proven themselves to be quite unruly, and therefore there's always the chance that they themselves might, if at some point in the future they see an opportunity, take actions into their own hands. So there is always a risk once you start getting involved in other people's blood feuds that the feud itself will have its own dynamic. But certainly insofar as they can, I think for the moment, until there's some dramatic political change, at the moment both the Russians and the Turks will precisely want to keep this frozen.
You know, the Caucasus is not the only area in Russia's near abroad where Turkey's been pretty active lately. I think it was about a month ago now that Erdogan was in Kyiv and he signed a strategic agreement on defense and trade with Zelensky. He reiterated his belief that Crimea belongs to Ukraine, that Ukraine will join NATO. And he's also even said similarly, like with Georgia, that Turkey supports a pathway to joining NATO for Georgia. And then, you know, even a little further away in some of the Central Asian republics like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, Turkey has been pursuing investment and defense cooperation agreements in recent years. So I want to ask you, Mark, do you think that any of these actions in parts of, you know, the old Soviet Union are something that catches Russia's attention in any way about what Turkey could be up to or the impact it could have on Russia?
I think we need to see this on multiple levels. You know, if one looks at, for example, precisely the deals that Turks have been striking in Central Asia, I think Moscow regards, and rightly, this just simply as part of the usual economic diplomacy of any country. You look for markets, you look for deals. If you can sell things, if you can buy things, you make suitable arrangements to do so. To be honest, in Central Asia, the struggle is between Moscow and Beijing. In that respect, Turkey is a negligible player. So that doesn't, I think, really bother them and won't in the future. On the second level, I mean, it is really quite interesting, Turkey's speaking in some ways as if it is speaking for NATO, when we also consider that, in fact, Turkey is in some ways a rather disgruntled and semi-detached member of NATO.
Of course, the last 100 issue he's met.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, you have the fact that, well, I mean, Erdogan has basically been held the European Union hostage with Syrian refugees, threatening to unleash 3.6 million of them if they continue to be sort of snarky and not make a deal with him in the past. You have exactly this business about buying leading edge Russian weapons, which again is an interesting example of this sort of complex relationship between the two countries. And so in that respect, one could almost wonder whether Georgia or Ukraine will be thinking, actually, don't get involved in this particular conversation because it may not help them. But yeah, I mean, it is, I think, reflective of Turkey's willingness to basically try and punch above its weight. Turkey is involved. I mean, there's all this sort of neo-Ottoman type talk, which I'm not sure. It makes for snappy headlines, but I'm not sure actually how much it really reveals. But I mean, I think what Turkey has clearly committed itself to is to establishing for itself a role as a regional power. And the region, you know, being sort of in some ways a bit of a sort of intermarium and beyond type thing, you know, includes both Georgia and Ukraine. And therefore, it actually feels that it has a stake there. And by championing NATO membership, something which, let's be perfectly honest, is not in any way imminent, this gives warm fuzzies without actually committing to anything serious. But the third level and the last level I'd want to look at is actually the difference between the Georgia and Ukraine situations. In Georgia, There is an interesting relationship with Turkey, but in some ways the Georgians themselves are being very careful in trying to maintain some degree of equipoise, a lot of rhetorical commitment to the West, while at the same time not pushing Moscow too far. Ukraine is in a very difficult position, or different rather position, particularly now that seeing, one presumes, the arrival of a Biden presidency. It's now getting a lot more robust in its operations on the Donbass border. And those hawks who have actually argued that it is time for a military campaign to retake the rebellious Donbass, I won't say they're in the ascendant, but certainly they're being heard a lot more loudly. I mean, I think in some ways it's a very dangerous path to take, but they didn't ask me. And in that context, I think it's quite interesting that, for example, it's not just that the Turks see this as an opportunity to sell more kit, though they're certainly pushing the successes of their Bayraktar drones in Ukraine. Though, I will be honest, against modern multi-layer air defense systems, they would have much, much less of a dramatic sort of impact. But then, that's, again, my job is not to sell or not sell Turkish drones. But beyond that, I think what they've also been saying, and I think this is something we've had a few hints about that have sort of been leaked in the Ukrainian media, is precisely that the success of Azerbaijan against what was notionally, after all, a Russian ally, is precisely being hyped as a sign that Moscow is currently politically weak or undecided, and that therefore this represents a potential window of opportunity. Now, again, I think that they will discover that it's a very, very different situation in the Donbass rather than Nagorno-Karabakh. But nonetheless, I think it's interesting that there seem to be Turkish voices, not necessarily diplomats, but people, shall we say, adjacent to the government, who are absolutely sort of talking up the window of opportunity for Ukraine.
You ended up touching on another topic that I'm interested in getting your view on, actually. You know, now that we have Biden on his way to the White House in January, and, you know, whenever I've spoken to guests about the U.S. and Turkey's relationship, potentially under Biden, it always comes back to the S-400 issue. And it's widely expected that he's going to act against Turkey on the S-400, which I imagine is something, you know, Russia would probably want to play a wait and see approach with, because any further rupture between the U.S. and Turkey could, you know, have that effect of pushing Turkey, at least in some ways, closer to Russia. But then Turkey had something of a riposte recently, where they were saying that in some other NATO member states, such as Greece, that they already have Russian air defense systems based there, such as the S-300. And they're wondering, why not us? So, but I want to ask you, what is the difference really between, of course, like that at that time when Greece might have been implementing this Russian missile system versus, of course, today where Turkey's now trying to, you know, use the S-400, though, you know, it's mixed on what they end up saying. Sometimes it's that they're not going to implement it as part of the NATO system, or they're just purposely ambiguous about the whole thing. So what is the difference between the situations then and now for the players?
Well, I think in some ways the reason why the S-400 became almost such a totemistic sort of issue is the idea that as soon as you start to use the advanced radar systems on this, they'll be able to pick up all kinds of other emissions, including potentially be able to sort of scan the brand new American fighters that Turkey was also meant to be buying, and that somehow the Russians would still be able to tap into this and get this. Now, I have absolutely no idea if that is technically possible or not. I have heard highly credentialed military experts argue both sides of the case, so that's fine. But it's more that, you know, it happened at a time when in some ways America was going through a particular bizarre period of its own politics, in which talking about Russia was never really talking about Russia. It was actually about the White House and whether or not you felt that Donald Trump was Putin's puppet and so forth. And I see everything Russian became seen as sinister, conspiratorial, and downright evil by largely a Democrat-controlled Congress. Now, in that context, this whole issue of the S-400 kind of almost acquired its own momentum. And after a certain point, and this is what happens in politics, in a way, positions have been built. You can't really easily step back and say, actually, come to think of it, the missile will be fine. We would rather you didn't, but big deal. Because then you're in effect admitting that it was always something of a historical moral panic in the first place. So in some ways, I think they are stuck with this. And particularly when one looks at the people who seem likely to be shaping Biden's Russia policy in the future, they are relatively hawkish. So I think there will be this area of pressure. And it's also because actually there is a sense that Turkey precisely has become too willful an ally. And this is a useful excuse to try and, in a way, as they would see it, bring Turkey back into the fold, or more bluntly, to house train it. So I think, unfortunately, the Americans are not likely to let this go. And likewise, this becomes, for the Turks, quite an issue of national pride as well as security capabilities. Now, I imagine that if actually America is willing to buy the Turks off by offering it its most advanced systems at some ludicrously cheap rate, and so forth, then maybe Erdogan will be willing to make a deal. He has demonstrated that he's a very, very pragmatic foreign policy operator, if need be. But that's the point. It will actually be, I think, the Americans. I mean, if the Americans simply rely on sanctions, they can expect and rely on Erdogan to push back, because that is what he has done in the past. And frankly, it has worked quite well for him. So I think if the Americans want to really have any progress, they're going to have to make a deal with him, which again, actually will play to Erdogan's strengths. It will show that he is able to make it to in a way force the only remaining superpower left in the world to make a deal with him on his terms. If they want something from him, well, they're going to have to come give him some good reason for it. So I think in this respect, actually the Americans have, ironically enough, done Erdogan a favor.
Interesting. And, you know, it's almost, you know, a duel of two national egos in this case. And you know, to my understanding, under NATO's rules, they mentioned it over the summer when Turkey had first received the S-400 that they had the right to procure military equipment, as it still is like a sovereign decision. And that seemed to kind of play into a lot of their, one of their recent lines of argument that the S-300 already is being used by NATO members, and you have Russian equipment all across NATO, and there's not similar complaints. Do you think there's some credence to Turkey's frustration there, or is it different circumstances?
I mean, I think in fairness, there are different circumstances. I mean, this notion of the S-400 radars being potentially a source of sort of compromising intelligence gathering for the Russians, it doesn't apply to, I don't know, the Czech Republic still using updated Soviet era kit that they inherited when they became independent from the Warsaw Pact. So generally speaking, you know, we're not really comparing like with like. We're not talking about other NATO countries having procured advanced Russian systems, or particularly or this advanced Russian systems. But as I say, I'm not entirely convinced, though, that this really is actually about the capabilities of the S-400, because it hasn't yet been demonstrated in any way that the Russians actually would be able to access the telemetry data and so forth that's gathered by the radars. It really is just one of these things that issues the real topic is wider issues. You have a Europe that is unhappy with Turkey, that regards Turkey, frankly, as an antagonist more than anything else. You have an American government which has basically regarded anything Russian as being somehow tainting and dangerous, and also feels that, you know, NATO member Turkey should be getting into line. It hasn't been happy with much of what has been being done in Turkey. And put that lot together, and the S-400, in my opinion, becomes just simply a convenient excuse rather than a real issue in its own right. And so exactly, and I think for those Turks who want to think about the actual issue itself, it's quite understandable how they get frustrated about this notion that somehow the S-400 is so totally different from everything else.
You know, earlier this month, I saw that Sergey Lavrov, he did a interview with Kommersant, and one of the questions he got was interesting to me. And the question was essentially worded like, how much longer is Russia willing to tolerate Turkey playing spoiler in areas that they're both interacting in, and that's being a spoiler was using military force, hard power, to get its means and just sort of flip the table, so to speak. And I want to ask you, how would you characterize really like how Russia sees Turkey's willingness to resort to force in these kind of areas, whether it's, you know, sending proxy forces to Libya, or, you know, the kind of support we saw in Nagorno-Karabakh, or then, of course, you know, the large kind of like military surge they had back in February in Idlib. Do you think this is something that's going to frustrate Russia? Do you think it's just something that they're accustomed to negotiating around at this point?
Yes, I think the latter. I mean, obviously, you know, Turkey is willing to be a lot more muscular than most of the nations with which Russia has to interact. But the interesting thing is, I mean, how often has Russia itself been decried by the West as acting as a spoiler through the use of its military force? I mean, in many ways, the thing is that actually Turkey and Russia have really quite similar approaches to the realpolitik around them. Maybe very, very different regimes in many ways. But in terms of just how they see the opportunities for the use of direct force, proxy force, and kind of implicit, or shall I say, sort of covert and deniable force, I think are really quite strikingly similar. And look, this annoys the Russians when it runs counter to their own interests, when it's in exactly Libya or Syria or the South Caucasus or whatever. But I don't get the feeling that they regard it as in any way inappropriate. You know, it's the rules of the game as they do it. And I think they tend to be quite willing to accept that. I mean, one of the sort of, I think, pivotal moments for understanding this goes back to 2015, when the Turks shot down this Russian Sukhoi 24 bomber that was operating in northern Syria, but was just cutting across a small sort of part of Turkish airspace. And, you know, it is very clear that the Turkish aircraft were actually were ready and waiting. I mean, this was an ambush. It was a route that a lot of Russian planes had taken in the past. And Turkish planes were ready for them and shot it down straight away. And obviously there was absolute fury in Moscow, and Putin describing it as sort of backstabbing by terrorist sympathizers and so forth. And there was a period of sanctions, economic sanctions, you know, on tourism and vegetables and all the various other things. The Turks didn't back down, quite the opposite. They demonstrated that they were willing to accept that. And although Erdogan eventually issued a sort of non-apology, if anything, it was the Russians that backed away from confrontation. They realized they tried it. They tried to see if they could sort of deter and overawe the Turks. And when that didn't happen, they just more or less said, okay, fair enough. And the interesting thing is, I haven't encountered people in Moscow who, you know, talking to people who are kind of related to the whole foreign policy decision-making and so forth, who really hold that against Ankara. There is that sense of, well, hey, these are the rules of the game. You know, we tried it. If we'd been able to get away with it, we would, but we didn't. Never mind, big deal. In a way that actually they do get very, very viscerally frustrated, I feel, with the West, because they really don't understand the West. They don't really understand Western democracies. They essentially regard the Western democracies as being hypocrites who believe in pragmatic geopolitics, but keep talking about values-based and such like. So ironically enough, you know, when it goes back to this whole business of being a spoiler, I think, you know, the Russians feel on familiar territory. Sometimes they're going to win, sometimes they're going to lose, but they don't have a problem with the rules of the game when it comes to Turkey.
So essentially they kind of just accept that sort of tug of war dynamic between them.
This is familiar. This is how they think that the world is anyway. I mean, and their view is that the West, frankly, operates by the same rules, but puffs itself out and claiming that it's doing this on moralistic grounds. So in some ways it feels actually with the Turks, look, we're on the same page, we're using the same language, that's fine, let's just see where the game goes.
Mark Aliotti, it's been a pleasure to have you on this morning and to talk about Russia and Turkey. I really hope that you can join me again sometime in the future for this topic.
And very much enjoyed doing this and absolutely happy to in the future.
And, there's always going to be something going on in that neighborhood between Russia and Turkey. So I suspect that's going to probably be sooner rather than later.
I'm sure there is.
All right, Mark, it's been a pleasure to have you.
As I said, my pleasure. Happy to talk.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.